You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Reading Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. We're on section 47. Which I believe is page 80.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
We were going to, tiny small talk. We discovered our 7-month-old daughter is allergic to peanuts today. She had a little bit of a peanut snack and seemed to be fine for a while. So then we let her have some more. And then about an hour later, she threw up everywhere and then threw up again. And so 2.5% of all children have peanut allergies, so
and it does run in the family.
Runs in my genes. So she's very special,
yes.
And we will deal. Yes. No breathing problems, just vomiting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so we're about to learn a lot about peanut allergies.
Which is good.
Yeah.
It's good to learn. Maybe we'll start a podcast on peanut allergies. But you know, we're not morose about it, right? We're not cynical or pessimistic.
No.
I have a daughter who has a peanut allergy from a prior situation.
Yeah.
She's lived all her life with it and she's been fine.
Yeah.
It is a total pain in the butt, but you know, I mean, just, it can be a hassle avoiding food with peanuts in it.
Yeah.
But we don't yet know that
that
our 7-month-old's allergy is going to persist or be severe. We just don't know.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a good sign she didn't vomit right away. I don't know.
Yes.
We're gonna learn.
That's the little family news.
Yeah.
She's still very beautiful and special.
Yeah. She was very sweet. Despite feeling sick. She did a lot of like laying her head on me while she
being kind of tired and groggy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I divorced Cranky today.
Oh yeah,
that's big news.
Yeah,
for some reason I feel like I'd been really cranky.
Yeah, that's true. It's been very pleasant
for probably decades. And I just decided today that the way to solve your relationship, to end your relationship with Cranky, is just not to be cranky.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the nice thing is that Cranky. My take is that what it really means is that I need to react to all the stimulus in my life in a non-cranky way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not really about what I feel or what's going on inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about my external reaction to things, like, you know, like the kids spilling the milk or the ninth tantrum of the morning or whatever inconvenience or hassle or thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, in other words, I would say reacting positively to the little things in life turns out to actually just make me feel uncranky.
Mm.
So I think it's the negative reactions
that gets you feeling
that
cranky.
We're feeding the cranky as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah.
So cranky wasn't necessarily causing it. It's that cranky was the result of my negative reactions to things. So now I'm just reacting positively to everything.
It's amazing.
And my cranky is gone.
It is gone.
So that is really, I mean, that's the $1 million tip right there.
Yeah.
Is that stop worrying about being cranky and actually just react positively to everything and your cranky will go away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the other news is, I don't know if you saw on Instagram, but the spring break show was announced. So I think last time we talked, we were like, we're not going to New York. I don't know if we ever said that.
Oh,
but
we
are going to New York. And
Spring Break Art Show.
And the LA one is announced, which was kind of fun.
The LA one?
The LA virtual one.
Oh, geez.
Sorry, right. I shouldn't even say it. But
so
it was
your work
still,
is
like,
appearing
fun.
In the LA virtual art show for Spring Break.
Yes.
Spring Break Art Show. Yes. And you're going to appear in the Spring Break Art Show in New York in early May.
Yes, we are.
We decided to go.
Yes.
Okay. That's wonderful news.
Okay. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I have something else, but I will bring it up when we get talking.
Okay. Anyhow, that was the kind of community announcements. It was less small talk and more community announcements. Okay, so we're going to read the book.
Yes.
Go ahead. We're on section 47.
47, the essence of the decision, being or non-being, can be determined only out of the essential occurrence of decision itself. Decision is decision between an either and an or. Thereby, however, what is proper to decision is indeed already forestalled. Whence the either or? Whence the only this or only that? Whence the unavoidability of this way or else that way? Is there not still a third indifference? Nevertheless, here at the extremity, that is not possible. What is here the extreme, being or non-being, and specifically not the being of some beings or other, such as human beings, but the essential occurrence of being or? Why does it come to an either or here? I think you should.
Oh, you think I should go over that?
Yeah.
That seems so simple. No. Decision is decision between an either and an or. So, right? Like, I mean, am I going to get the piano tuned or am I not going to get the piano tuned?
But that's like the decision and the version of choice that I thought was not actually decision.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess maybe Heidegger is being on Heideggerian. No, I'm not sure. Decision is decision between an either and an or. Thereby, however, what is proper to decision is indeed already forestalled. I mean, I think what he's saying is the traditional understanding of decision is that it's an either or.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you're already at that point where you're deciding between this or that, then what is proper to decision is already forestalled. So it's already kind of done away with. Whence the either or? Whence the only this or only that? Why are we at this point where the it's this way or that way? Is there still not a third indifference? Well, at the extremity, that is not possible. What is here the extreme, being or non-being? And specifically not the being of some beings or other, such as human beings, but the essential occurrence of being. Or, I don't understand that paragraph. I mean, what is here the extreme, being or non-being? And specifically, not the being of some beings or other, such as human beings, the essential occurrence of being. I mean, it seems, I don't know, he seems to be pointing us to decision somehow being at present in the extreme between being or non-being. Why does it come to an either or here? I'm not sure what's going on. Like, I think we should keep reading.
Okay. Indifference would merely be a being of non-beings, merely a higher nothingness. For, quote, being does not here mean objective presence in itself, and non-being does not here mean a complete disappearance. Instead, non-being as a mode of being, it is, and yet is not. And likewise, being permeated with the quote, not, and yet it is. To take this back into the essential occurrence of being requires insight into the belonging of nothingness to being, and only in that way does the either or receive its sharpness and its origin.
Okay, so I think here we're, instead of talking about whether the decision is to get the piano tuned or not, he seems to be saying that So in the extreme where indifference is not possible, and that would be where decision is faced with a being or a not being, a non-being decision. So whether something is or something is not. He seems to want to say that the distinction between being and non-being. So if we're going to decide whether something is or not, right? Mm-hmm. This instead, non-being as a mode of being. Mm-hmm. Non-being is and yet is not. And likewise, being is permeated with the not and yet it is. Mm-hmm. So I think he's trying to say here that the distinction between being and non-being, the clarity of this way or that way, the either or, is actually an extreme state of, in a way, a radical or an end game partitioning of things. Mm-hmm. But between being and non-being, the distinction is not so clear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So to take this back into the essential occurrence of being, so to take this idea of being and non-being and non-being and being and the either-or being not quite so distinct, to take this back into the essential occurrence of being requires insight into the belongingness of nothingness to being, the belonging of nothingness to being. So nothingness belongs to being, and only in that way does the either-or receive its sharpness and its origin. Yeah. Since let's keep reading. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Since being is permeated with the quote not, for the perseverance of its truth, it needs the persistence of the not, and thus also non-beings, the counterpart of everything negative. The essential negativity of being turning entails that being requires and needs that which shows itself in terms of Dasein as an either or, the one or the other, and only these. The essential occurrence of the decision is the leap into the decision, or else is indifference, thus not withdrawal and not destruction. Indifference is non-deciding. The decision is originally about whether there is decision or non-decision. Yet decision is bringing oneself before the either-or, and thereby is already decidedness, because here already there is belonging to the event. The decision about decision turning, not reflexivity, but its opposite, decision about the decision, i.e. already knowing the event. Decision and question, questioning as more originary, placing the essence of truth up for decision, but truth itself is already that which is to be decided per se.
Yeah, I mean, we get a feeling here that these are, I mean, there's a, like a notebooky, notey feel to this, kind of jotting down ideas, which is a good way of me trying to excuse myself from knowing what the narrative flow here is. but, so he seems to be playing back and forth, I'm not quite sure in what way, that being and non-being are related. I'm not sure how they relate to the either or, and I'm not sure whether, in what way, in the extremity of decision, being or non-being play out, what the relationship is to that state. But he dives into bang, and he says, since bang is permeated with the not, bang has the not in in its essence, because bang is event, and so every event is not any other event, and every event is not only surrounded by not, in that it soon will not be, but every event is not other things, so there's not in its delineation as an event. Since bang is permeated with the not, for the perseverance of its truth, it needs, so in order for its truth to persevere, it needs the persistence of the not, and thus also non-beings, the counterpart of everything negative. The essential negativity of being entails that being requires and needs that which shows itself. The essential negativity of being entails that being requires and needs that which shows itself in terms of Dasein as an either or, the one or the other, and only these. Yeah, so the essential negativity of being is that there is being and there is non-being. And this this sort of dichotomy sets up Dasein to only know being as an either or. The essential occurrence of the decision is the leap into the decision, or else is indifference. So the first decision to be made is to leap into decision or not, which is, you know, not withdrawal or destruction. Indifference is non-deciding, true enough. The decision is originally about whether there is decision or non-decision. Yes, so we must decide whether we're going to decide or not. Yet decision is bringing oneself before the either-or, and thereby is already decidedness, because you're already there as belonging to the event. So, in a sense, when decision faces an either-or, it is already decided that it is going to be decision. So, again, maybe he's trying to point us to this idea that prior to decision, we should decide whether we're going to decide, and that that decision of deciding, or taking the leap to decide, is prior to being and non-being, prior to this or that. In that decidedness, or that in that, then in that decision about decision, there is a sort of a pre-place, prior to being and non-being, where being is saturated by non-being and non-being by being, or not by not. The decision about decision, not reflexivity, so not a reflexive decision just reflecting back onto itself, but its opposite, decision about the decision, i.e. already knowing the event, already knowing what event is going to occur when the decision occurs. Decision and question. Questioning as more originary. It's placing the essence of truth up for decision. So when you face a decision, an either or, a this or that, what he's saying is you can also just question about, constantly question, what am I deciding between? What is this decision? Is the either or that I'm presented with really a clear-cut either or? Or should I do some more questioning and try to figure out where one resides in the other, and the so-called this or that is not as clear-cut as I believe? In other words, place the essence of truth up for decision. So what is the truth of this either or? How is this truth, the truth that I'm facing, how is it laying itself out? Question the either or. Truth is that which is to be decided per se. We are really deciding about truth, and we're deciding how truth will manifest itself. So, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should we read the next little section?
I think so, yeah. I think it's slightly related.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe it will shed a little light on...
Does indifference mean the opposite of decision, or does it mean uninterest? Or like just not caring or something.
Yeah. I think it means a little of both, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the word is in German, but indifference in English definitely is like, oh, I don't really care.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Okay. Let's do 48.
Mm-hmm.
48. In what sense the decision belongs to being itself? The decision and the plight as the unrest of the thrownness of the projector. The decision and the strife. The decision and the turning. It seems as if the decision regarding whether to be or not to be is always already decided in favor of the, quote, to be, end quote, since, quote, life indeed means wanting to be. Thus, nothing at all is up for decision here. Yet what does, quote, life mean, and how extensively is, quote, life grasped here as the drive to self-preservation? Even the common and lowly, the massive and indolent, have a drive to preserve themselves, and that is precisely what they have. Consequently, the question of the decision cannot be posed in terms of such considerations.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so we start with the decision and the plight as the unrest of the thrownness of the projector. The thrownness of the projector really, I think, is another way of saying in a sense, the existential situation of Dasein. Dasein is thrown into the world. And proceeds to project into the world, and the decision and the plight are the unrest of this thrownness. That makes sense. The decision and the strife, the decision and the turning. It seems as if the decision regarding whether to be or not to be is always already decided in favor of the to be, since life indeed means wanting to be. Thus, nothing at all is up for decision here. Yet, what does life mean, and how extensively is life grasped here as the drive to self-preservation? That reminds me of what we were talking about a little about last time, which is vis-a-vis anxiety, sort mm-hmm. of the drive to self-preservation being, you know, what you are organismically,
mm-hmm.
and the.
The biological imperative.
Yeah, exactly. And the lack of appreciation of how definitive mm-hmm. and decisive that is in being. And of course, Heidegger here is dropping in the to be or not to be question of Shakespeare. As somehow the most essential decision, and he's saying it's not really much of a decision at all, since obviously you are deciding to be.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good clue into what he's trying to get at here, is that we sit there and we think, I'm deciding between to be or not to be, and that's focusing on a certain type of decision, but it's a little hypocritical because another type of decision is being made as you are sitting there ostensibly questioning whether you should be or not to be. And that decision, which is sort of more the type of decision that Heidegger's trying to push us into thinking about, and that is that you are deciding to be. While you are deciding to be.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the normal way that decision is thought of as an either or, but the drive to self-preservation is a deciding. It's not an indifference, it's a deciding that is occurring all the time. Even the common and lowly, the massive and indolent, I guess that's even the big fat people, I'm not sure what that means, have a drive to preserve themselves. Even those who you would think probably, why should they do?
Yeah.
And that is precisely what they have. They have a drive to preserve themselves. Consequently, the question of the decision cannot be posed in terms of such considerations. Yeah. So this is a little exciting. We're actually near the end of this massive section. I think we should keep reading.
Oh my gosh. Oh my God, we are.
Because you'll see that
In
about a page, we reach in a sense, like, I don't know what you call it, like section two.
Yeah.
But okay. So we're at the very end of this, like, section one. I guess all everything else was the subsections.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what this section is called. We should look. But let's read subsection 49, and we'll make it to the end of this first part. Let's
call maybe prospect.
Call it parts. Part one?
Prospect.
Great. Yeah. So this whole time we've been reading part one of Contributions to Philosophy event called Prospect. So we are now about to reach the end of part one. Go ahead.
I just want to say it's like it's interesting that in a way he's kind of like, this isn't even a decision worth talking about, essentially, right?
Yeah.
When he says to be or not to be is just like so not even worth talking about.
Yeah.
Because it's so obvious that like we're talking about it.
I agree. And I think it's very indicative of the kind of territory that Heidegger's trying to push his philosophy into, in saying that, you know, a lot of philosophy, a lot of talk, a lot of psychology, a lot of ethics, a lot of social sciences deal with these decisions that Heidegger would kind of categorize as to be or not to be, right? And he's kind of saying that's kind of a stupid question.
Yeah, it's like not even a question.
Yeah, in a way. And my philosophy is trying to get us in touch with the decision that is the drive to self-preservation, which is a deeper, prior realm of decision, and is where he's trying to push his philosophy into taking residence and providing insight into the dynamics of that realm.
Yeah.
Which I think is really exciting, again, about the subtopic of anxiety with this podcast is like, I think we mentioned last episode, it's like so much of anxiety resolution theory is about this decision, the types of decisions you're supposed to make. And all that kind of to be or not to be, either or, this way or that way, decision stuff, choosing, sits on top of a deeply ignored and in a way suppressed realm of decision, which is what's going on in the drive to self-preservation and how is that decision being made? What are the organs? What are the levers? What are the ambitions and objectives that constitute that decision? And how can we live in that decision and ask about that decision and not be so hung up on the more artificial decisions that aren't really decisions? Because in the end, we seem to be hell-bent on denying that we are deciding all the time. Because we don't recognize that it is a decision.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, it feels like it's being decided for us.
Well, that's the thing, the drive to self-preservation, what decision is there really there if it's already been decided?
Okay, it sounds a very Heideggerian question, right? Like, I mean, I think...
Although I guess that's just this new kind of decision in a way, and that it's not about it's not about saying to be or not to be, it's about saying...
What is the nature of the decision that I'm making right now by self-preserving? What are the choices I'm making? How is that being made for me? What am I making? What's making that decision? Why am I making that decision? Where did that decision come from? How did I end up in that position to be making that decision?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a greatly overlooked, ignored realm of our existence.
Mm-hmm.
That if we could look at how that decision, that decisionary space... Mm-hmm. is precedent in just existing,
mm-hmm.
we might see that making the right decisions vis-a-vis all these other things is a little irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah, and it really sort of, it takes it right to the sort of thing that he's been saying now for, I guess, probably a few sections, which is, sorry to say this again, but just like that it isn't a choice. You're not deciding between two things. You're not deciding about a morality. What you're actually deciding about is well, maybe he's about to say, why must decision take place? But what you're really deciding about is if you're there in the event, I guess, or mm-hmm. if you're open to the event or mm-hmm. something.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess in this case, if you're like, I don't know, recognizing the drive to self-preservation, or I guess it's sort of what you were just saying about all those sort of questions about self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about saying, yeah, it's not about saying, am I, yeah, it's just a different way of thinking about decision. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, yeah, well, and also I think when we think about decision in the normal way, that the either or and the this or that, we get a sense of having a faculty of decision.
Yeah.
And a sense of, like a an organ or a skill mm-hmm. set of decision. Mm-hmm. Or there's a, it's almost like it's a point mm-hmm. when from which we decide. And it's very conscious. It's very, I don't know, I use mm-hmm. this word hesitatingly, but it's very ego. It's mm-hmm. very, it's very the frontal node of your personality that's, it's the commander, it's making these decisions, it's out in the front lines mm-hmm. choosing this or that. And we become, I would say, kind of used to and fixated on viewing ourselves as being first and foremost this decisionary node, this mm-hmm. out front decisionary node, mm-hmm. and that's where all the action is. That's where we happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's where our fate is made.
Yes.
That's where we either get better or worse.
Yeah.
That's
get the part or not.
That's right. That's the drama of our life. That's
drive
the,
or not.
That's right. That's the question. Like, will that function, that faculty, get it right this time, you know? Mm-hmm. And we're constantly working it like a, you know, like a gear or an employee mm-hmm. or a commander who, you know, we invest in its, we invest hope in it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a real shape to the mind, a real architecture of concentration and focus and cathectic investment. But Heidegger's saying here, let's look back from that. Let's look away from that. Mm-hmm. Let's step back from that. Let's leave that place where being and non-being are set up as these either or juxtapositions and realize that back in what we more fundamentally are, where being is non-being and non-being is being and bang is saturated with not, there's a whole nother world where decisions are being made,
mm-hmm.
where decidedness is occurring. And that is Dasein, and that is our appropriation to bang, and that is where things are really happening for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's in the deep state of us, yeah, of ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
It's in the deep state of ourselves that our governance is really happening.
Yeah, right.
And if you want your governance to change, you've got to clean out the deep state.
Yeah.
Because that's where the decisions are being made. It's actually a very good analogy.
Yeah, it actually is, because it's also like, especially like if you don't know what's going on there, like most of us,
yeah,
no idea what's going on there, and but
no.
it controls a lot.
No,
so it's, illuminating it's, the deep state.
It's an outstanding analogy, because I think, you know, what people are kind of pro what's happening with the politics right now vis-a-vis the Trump administration and the deep state, what they're saying is that for many, many years, you know, since there's been a so-called Washington bureaucracy, which is, you know, 150 years. I don't know. You know, I mean, the government kind of really exploded after the Civil War, but certainly in the 1900s. Ever since there's been that democracy, that bureaucracy, you know, presidents have been elected. And to a lesser degree, I mean, not to a lesser degree, but more disparately, congressional representatives have been elected. And they have been they've had the veneer of being decisionary powers, making policy, making decisions, enacting the will of the people. Mm-hmm. But underneath all this has been the growth, perpetual growth of this bureaucracy, this deep state that has been, that is also making decisions.
Yeah.
And those decisions are just kind of always occurring. And in a way, they are, they have become sometimes very disjointed from the agential promontory of president or leaders of Congress, etc., and it just going on in the background. They're a background force churning away, and in a way representing the government's drive to self-preservation.
Yeah, it's true.
But that they have operated in darkness, and that we have been so focused on the president and our elected officials that the bureaucracy and the actions of the deep state have been, you know, have been allowed to swell and go on in complete ignorance. But they are actually sort of what keeps the government going. Yeah, and so it's a good analogy.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And, you know, I think there are people who are opposed to looking into the deep state.
Yeah.
And there are people who are into looking into the deep state. I think that's probably just simply politics, and some people think the deep state is working for them and some people think it's not.
Yeah.
But I think that the drive to not look into the deep state and the resistance to looking into the deep state, I would say in a certain sense, feels to me like it's coming from people who are very focused on the either or decisions in life. They're focused on correctness.
The right decision.
Making the right decisions. That's right.
And they I
are,
would say
they are the pro-choice. They're the pro-choice.
Yeah.
Literally. True. That's the word.
Well,
they use
and it's
themselves.
Like there's, I think, there's a decision that's right and a decision that's wrong. Basically, if.
Yeah. Yeah.
And definitely the pro-choice side. I mean.
Yeah, and we're not talking about abortion here. That was tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, but, you know.
It's more. I mean, again, I think that a little what's going on is that people on the Democrat or liberal side feel that the deep state is acting in their interest.
Yeah.
So they're not interested in dismantling the deep state because it's working for them.
Yeah, but I think the idea, because this really ties into how we've discussed liberalism, not the political, but the, what is it, philosophical, social?
Yes.
Is like, it has really come to this point where there is a correct answer, that it's saying that it's about a decision for this or that. We're saying that we're choosing a decision for this or that, but there's one side that's the correct answer.
Yes.
So pro-choice is the correct answer.
Yes.
I'm not sure how many people would say, oh, but it's also okay if you're pro-life, because we get that some people have different opinions.
Right.
However, it seems like in a way, more on the other side, there is a bit more of a sense that, well, it's okay if you're, well, is there or not? I don't know. Is there?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, maybe everyone on the other side. Well,
there's a lot of galvanization.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, people are
hating the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's a terrible example, but I have been hearing more, but maybe both sides just claim that they are more open to hearing from both sides. I don't know. But I think that's like a big issue that we have seen with the Democratic Party, is that it seemed to really be like saying that everyone who doesn't agree with them is terrible and racist and stupid and evil.
Yeah.
And that's something I guess I've been kind of complaining about for a while, is I'm like, I just don't get how you can say that half the country is like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, they call you, like there should be a right for people to have different opinions. And that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
Has been missing in the messaging anyways of the party.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of people on the right who think people on the left are out of their minds and incorrect and wrong and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one thought I had this week was that in a actual democracy, not in the minimalist definition of a democracy, in the simple sense of a democracy functioning as a way that the will of the people becomes the governing force in that direct relationship, good governance or the sign of the health of a democracy. So here's what I want to say. The health of a democracy, and we use this phrase, is not what liberals often say, which is that a democracy is perpetuating and enacting a variety of principles that align with liberalism's ideals. Mm-hmm. The health of democracy is actually can actually be captured in one word, and that is transparency. Mm-hmm. Meaning, in a democracy, you vote for people, they go into power, and then they ostensibly are supposed to carry out the policies that they promised to carry out when they were running for office.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And if they are transparent about exactly how they're doing that, and everything they're doing as leaders is completely transparent, then that is a healthy democracy. Mm-hmm. An unhealthy
because the will of the people is then going into action.
Whether you like what the will of the people asked to be done in their name.
Right. And I was also thinking also just like the peaceful transfer of power from one side to another is another.
Well, yes.
But like you let the other side win even if you're not happy that they won.
Yes, yes. And so what I was going to say is I think that non-transparency is what happens when a democracy is unhealthy, because the only reason for there to be non-transparency is because the elected officials are not carrying out the mandate they were handed to by the people. They were handed by the people. Mm-hmm. And so I think, to me, the issue that the right currently has with the deep state is less ideological. I think the liberals are being more ideological about it. Mm-hmm. And I think the right is saying, we were voted in. Mm. We want to be transparent. We want our government to be transparent. So we're getting rid of all the non-transparent aspects of our government that don't align with our sense of what we ought to be doing because we were voted in. And so it's more systemic. It's more like, it's more, I would say, pushing for democracy to actually be healthy and working and functioning. Whereas I think the other side is trying to hold on to a form of democracy, which is that democracy has a deep, dark state that is carrying out things that no one voted for. Mm-hmm. They're trying to hold on to that because it just so happens that that deep state is fulfilling their principles and their ideals. Mm-hmm. But it is inherently indicative of an unhealthy democracy because it is non-transparent.
Interesting. Yeah.
And how does that relate to what we're talking about? I mean, I don't know. You were trying to say that one side is hateful or, I would say a better way to think about it is one side is currently advocating for non-transparency.
Yeah.
And one side is advocating for transparency.
Yeah.
And I think that the side that is advocating for transparency is showing a deeper commitment to democracy.
Yeah.
Than the side that is advocating for non-transparency, because frankly, the sooner or later the Republicans are going to get voted out, and the Democrats are going to come in, right?
Yeah.
And the conditions of transparency that the Republicans put forward, the Democrats will then, sort of abide by that transparency, or will move back to non-transparency, but the health of the democracy will be on the table.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like some people might disagree.
That yeah, how would a liberal disagree with me with what I just said? I mean, I know they would say that the way the deep state is being investigated is non-transparent.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's
which I kind of disagree with.
I mean, it's not really relevant.
It's well, and it's pretty public. I mean, it's posted every day on Twitter, yeah. All over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
What's being found? You know, I mean, I don't know how they could be more transparent.
Yeah.
In fact, as Elon Musk says, he's like, I'm actually too transparent.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that.
But I mean, I think he's joking. But you know, I don't know. What were you gonna say?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess the idea is just that, like, the moral stature of the deep state is correct and is important and should be reified and what do you call it? Reproduced. It should be continued.
Moral stature of the deep state? What do you mean?
Well, I think that the general idea is that it's like a consistent cast of people. So like a consistent people over time. So they carry through time, right? So they aren't reelected with each administration, right? They're like same people. That's right. And that's part of the issue is that they don't necessarily represent who the people have voted to put into power because they are always the same and they seem to have a particular political leaning.
Right, and I think that's part of the issue is I think that probably they're saying the deep state is supposed to just be a bureaucracy
right.
that changes gears, changes policies, changes its outlays and its expenses and its distributions according to the administration that has been elected in.
And it hasn't been.
Yeah. It's been operating. But, that's largely the fault of everybody who's been brought in. Republicans have not really addressed that issue.
Yeah.
And Democrats have used it to their advantage. So,
yeah. I mean, but would a Democrat disagree with they say it has changed?
I would say they could say that, but I would say actually nobody knows because, again, the deep state has been operating in a non-transparent manner.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's the transparency that we all need to support. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
It is a nonpartisan, bipartisan, you know, you believe this or you just are clearly, you know, not for the game to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
You're for transparency. And, you know, if liberals want to say Musk and Trump aren't being transparent enough, then I would say, okay, great. Throw that criticism at them. Make them be more transparent. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Make them be more transparent, mm-hmm. which is not about making them stop what they're doing
mm-hmm.
because they were voted in and they're allowed to be doing what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
but they should be fully transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And so should the deep state. Mm-hmm. So should the liberal deep state be fully transparent. Everything should be mm-hmm. fully transparent, fully available. It should all be on the internet. It should all be there to be seen. Mm-hmm. We should see exactly how our money's being spent. We should know exactly what's going on. And we should see when a new administration is put in that the deep state is now responding to the principles and the policies and the ideals of the new administration.
Yeah.
And I'm 100% in favor of that being no matter who's voted in.
Yeah, totally.
So it's really the principle of transparency that mm-hmm. I think is the important one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now you've got one side doing things and the other side saying, wait a minute, you know, this transparency is making us nervous, which is why you have people on the right saying, when you start doing investigations and people say stop, then you know who you need to investigate.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyhow, that was politics. But I thought
do we want to do the last
section? Oh, I think we absolutely have to. Yeah.
Okay,
I thought the deep state was an interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
Again, let's go back. I think it was an interesting analogy for the decision.
Yeah.
The decision realms that Heidegger is setting up here.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay. 49. Why must decisions take place? Why must decisions take place? What is this decision? The necessary form in which freedom is carried out. To be sure, but we are thereby thinking, quote,
causally.
Sorry, causally. That's
okay. I saw it as casually when I first looked at it, too. Yeah, it's causally.
I'll just start over.
Sure.
49. Why must decisions take place? Why must decisions take place? What is this decision? The necessary form in which freedom is carried out, to be sure, but we are thereby thinking causally and taking freedom as a faculty. Is, quote, decision not also still a very refined form of calculation, or on account of the semblance, not only the extreme opposite, but even the incomparable? Decision seen as a human activity, as a series of processes. In decision is the necessary, that which, quote, resides prior to the, quote, activity and reaches beyond the activity. The temporal spatial character of decision as a erupting fissure of being itself, to be grasped in terms of the history of being, not morally, anthropologically. Preparatory clearing away, then precisely not a subsequent reflexivity, but the reverse. In general, to rethink in terms of the history of being, but not, quote, ontologically, the whole essence of the human being as soon as it is grounded in Dasein.
Yeah, good time to start another part of the book as he kind of starts to just defrag himself here. Right? Why must decisions take place? So I think he's...
Defrag? What do you mean? Just like...
You know, he's like, I don't know, defrag. What is defrag? It's like he's like sort of like... Well, he's actually refragging himself, yeah, right. Isn't he? Yeah, he's just kind of... It seems like he's kind of like just...
Spinning a little.
Spinning up and splitting up and spitting up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why must decisions take place? I mean, he's tripping out here. He's tripping out, and he's tripping out on this. I think he's taking jabs at asking, how can we think about decision in a new way and get at, and his very last paragraph takes us where he's trying to get at. How can we get at that and think about that as the location of decision? Mm-hmm. So why must decisions take place? Why must we even decide between things, right? What is it about us that constantly faces us with decisions? The necessary form in which what is the decision? It's the necessary form. So decision is the way freedom is carried out. To be sure, that's true. We become free, or freedom is carried out by decision. But we are thinking causally and taking freedom as a faculty. So, but. You know, freedom as a faculty, and again, decision as a faculty, as if decision causes freedom. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe decision is the opposite of freedom. Is decision not also still a very refined form of calculation? Yes, it is. Or, on account of this semblance, meaning decision and calculation seem similar, is decision not only the extreme opposite, but even the incomparable? Is it incomparable to calculation? Are they not really comparable? Are they not similar at all? Decision as a human activity is a series of processes. Indecision is the necessary, that which resides prior to the activity and reaches beyond the activity. Now, decision there is italicized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he might... I'm not sure if there's a difference between when decision is...
I know, when is decision switching?
But decision is the necessary. That's interesting. So that decision is, in a sense, what is necessary, or what we could call the drive to self-preservation, what resides prior to the activity and reaches beyond the activity. So the decision is always there, even prior to the activity of deciding. Mm-hmm. The temporal spatial character of decision is the erupting fissure of bang itself. So in the temporal spatial character of decision, there is bang, or the fissure of bang. Bang erupts out of it. To be grasped in terms of the history of being, And we grasp this bang as the history of being, not morally, anthropologically, but more as the history of being, not as just morality or anthropology. Preparatory clearing away, then precisely not a subsequent reflexivity, but the reverse. So we prepare a clearing, we, instead of a subsequent reflexivity, meaning a subsequent kind of repetition, it's the opposite of a reflexivity. It's a new creation, a new launch. In general, to rethink in terms of the history of being, the whole essence of the human being, as soon as it is grounded in Dasein. Mm-hmm. I think that's what he's trying to get at with decision. This decision that is prior to be or not to be, prior to the either or prior to this or that, is really and getting at that deep state of the mind, and that drive to self-preservation, that bangy decision, is to rethink in terms of the history of being the whole essence of the human being as soon as it is grounded in Dasein. So as soon as it's grounded in Dasein, it mm-hmm. becomes grounded in decision, mm-hmm. in the decision that it is its life, that is more than calculation, and engages it in a temporal spatial character that is the fissure of bang itself. It's the necessary. It's the activity prior to the activity. It's the deep state of your being. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think again, lessons there for like I would almost say like. The best phrase is like, how do you see yourself? mm-hmm. When you're asking about anxiety, when you're asking about making better decisions, when you're mm-hmm. asking about when you're asking about feeling better, getting better, doing better, being better, how do you see yourself? Who's doing the being better? Who's doing the deciding? What's it deciding on? Why are you deciding on those things? Why has that become such a pressing decision for you? How did you get to an either or? Do you have to make that decision? Is that really who you? Is that really where decisions are made? What other decisions are you making unconsciously? What decisions are you? What is your decidedness? How are you being decided for? Who's deciding for you? Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. That's very well said.
I just think that this emphasis on making the right decision.
Yeah.
Is a distraction from a deeper realm of decisioning that makes us so much of what we are.
Mm-hmm. But I guess again, I'm sorry to go back to this, but it's like if it's already been decided for you, I think he literally
said
that.
I didn't say it's already, but when hold on.
Well, no, he said. Well, yeah, right. I guess it's on.
I don't think he says
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he said to be or not to be has already been decided for you.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Right.
And so, but I mean.
But self-preservation, isn't that just a decision to be? But that's just the old way of decision.
It's not a decision to be in the way we think of the an either or.
Yeah.
It's a deciding.
Yeah,
but it's not an either or this or that. Mm-hmm. But it is a deciding, and it's a deciding embedded in bang, and embedded in the temporal spatial character of bang, and embedded in the thrownness of Dasein. And it is a deciding, but it's not an either or. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so he's trying to say there are decidings that are not either ors.
Yeah, right.
There are decidings that are different than calculations.
Yeah. Talk more about it. So what is it? I mean, it's what you're just saying, what else is what
well
is
he
it?
Says it there he calls it there the history of being.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Again, look at the deep state metaphor. If you think that electing a new president is going to change everything for you, mm-hmm. you're failing to see that the bureaucracy that mm-hmm. the president is now sitting on top of is 120 years old and has been making decisions in the dark for over a century and is going to continue to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's a the deep state is a deciding, and it's making decisions that influence the decisions that the president can make.
Yeah.
So it's about, I don't know, it's a realm of under decisions. It's a realm of deeper decisions. It's a realm of a perpetual deciding that the only way to kind of figure out what it is to look at the history of being and to engage in the series of events that represents. And so, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, again, vis-a-vis anxiety. And vis-a-vis anxiety, it's like all these books, it's like, you know, just make the right decision. Just make the, you know, well, but I don't know. It's about doing the systems analysis. It's about breaking into the databases, and it's about looking at all the books, and it's about looking at the way the whole structure has been churning your whole structure. What have you been doing? How have you been deciding? What's been going on? Mm-hmm. It just, we so deeply ignore that aspect of ourself.
Yeah.
And in ignoring it, we lose faith in it.
Yeah.
And in ignoring it, we lose touch with the fact that it is a deciding, and that we are its decision. And that can be comforting. Can be informative. It can be a new area of investigation. It can be a new way of thinking about yourself, seeing yourself. I think a lot of the fixation on the decisions that you need to make, the right decisions to cure anxiety, are anxiety inducing.
Totally.
I think you can't underestimate the degree to which we come to see ourselves as composed of certain elements that work together in a systemic dynamic way. But that seeing, that vision, that map, that sort of hologram we have of what we are and how we work and what's operating who and where and what and how, that is incomplete. It's just a culturally induced hallucination. And having a fuller, truer, deeper picture, which this book is trying to push us towards, will help just completely change the conversation about what you ought to be doing and where your anxiety is coming from and what you are and how you operate and what kind of levers and possibilities you have and where you are. Like, where are you? So many people think they are in, you know what they think? You know where they think they are? They think they're in this singularity, this little point where they're facing an either or, perpetually facing either ors. And that's about as large of a vision of themselves as they have.
Yeah.
It's a tiny little fulcrum where all these either ors go chunk, 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 chunk. You know, it's that TikTok, right? Where it's like, you point to the left or you point to the right, you know? Guys with blonde hair or black hair? Black hair. You know, guys who listen to heavy metal or rap? Rap. You know, it's just like, like life is just, for so many people, it's just that.
Yeah.
But Heidegger's just trying to say to us, let's look at the deep state.
Yeah.
Of what we are.
Yeah. What does prospectus or prospect mean?
Prospect?
Yeah, that's the name of this section we just finished.
P-R-O-S-P-E-C-T?
Yes.
Prospect. I mean, prospect, I guess, has a lot of definitions. I'd have to look at the German word.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I mean, do we have the German text here?
I don't know. I thought you said we did, but I'm not sure where it is.
I think it's... So prospect, let's read the definitions here, right? The possibility or likelihood of some future event occurring. Interesting, right?
Yeah.
A mental picture of a future or anticipated event. Yeah. Chances or opportunities for success or wealth. A person regarded as likely to succeed or as a potential customer client.
Right.
A place likely to yield mineral deposits. An extensive view of a landscape.
Wow, those like all apply.
They all, that's what we've just basically read. We've read about all that. Yeah.
Awesome.
Good?
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on finishing part one.
That's amazing. We did it.
Next episode, we will start part two, which is entitled The Resonating.
Exciting.
All right. Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.